they transferred him to Washington, D.C., as manager of the posh Four Ways restaurant off DuPont Circle. When I met him there, his Filipino wife and entourage were working as the kitchen and wait staff. To make sure Larry behaved himself, the CIA had placed a former security officer in charge of finances. This restaurant was the fanciest place I had ever been in my life. It was a place where striped pants State Department officials, foreign dignitaries, and business tycoons met to make deals while sampling fine wines and haute cuisine. Each lavishly appointed room had its own dining table and waiter. I was directed to a leather booth in the wood-paneled basement barroom, where Larry casually explained that each room was bugged by the CIA. As we were talking, a group of well-dressed young men and women, chaperoned by an older man, took the booth next to us. The rest of the barroom was empty. They ordered drinks, but remained silent and alert, as Larry explained the ins and outs of his CIA experience to me. At one point, Larry nodded to the older man at the next booth, then informed me that the young people listening to our conversation were junior officer trainees from Langley. Larry told me that the CIA manages a parallel society where deep cover agents like him, as well as retired CIA officers and their agents, are provided with comfortable employment in their retirement years, or when they otherwise need sanctuary and recompense for their services. Many of these agents have no applicable resume, so they are folded into this parallel universe as managers of the local Ford dealership or proprietors of a Chinese restaurant, or in hundreds of other jobs held in abeyance by cooperating businesses. Think of it as a witness protection program, which since 2001 has grown exponentially. It is the hidden geography of top-secret America, a subculture of highly trained operators with a dangerous set of skills that can be called upon at any moment. The one thing they have in common is that they are entirely dependent on the war criminals running the CIA. As John Lennon said, imagine. Chapter 20. How the Government Tries to Mess with Your Mind. Lou Rockwell. Those of us who were interested in the church hearings, which we don't hear much about anymore, learned about Operation Mockingbird, the CIA's program to take control of the U.S. media. Has Operation Mockingbird continued? Is the American mainstream media pretty much a PR operation for the CIA? Valentine. Mockingbird, as you know, was a program the CIA launched in the early 1950s to influence the mass media. CIA officers Cord Meyer and Frank Wisner are credited with creating Mockingbird. Meyer, through his friendship with the owner of Random House, tried to suppress Al McCoy's book, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, in 1972. Wisner famously referred to the CIA's army of Morley Safer-style assets in the publishing and journalism world as the Mighty Wurlitzer, which he could turn on and off whenever he wished. Wisner's son, by the way, served in the Phoenix program. In her book, Catherine the Great, Catherine Graham and the Washington Post, Deborah Davis said that by the early 1950s, according to Deborah Davis, Wisner had implemented his plan and owned respected members of the New York Times, Newsweek, CBS, and other communications vehicles, plus stringers, 400 to 600 in all, according to a former CIA analyst. Carl Bernstein, citing CIA documents, said basically the same thing in his famous 1977 expose for Rolling Stone. The CIA and the media, how America's most powerful news media worked hand in glove with the Central Intelligence Agency, and why the Church Committee covered it up. The CIA established a strategic intelligence network of magazines and publishing houses, as well as student and cultural organizations, and used them as front organizations for covert operations, including political and psychological warfare operations directed against American citizens. In other nations, the program was aimed at what Cord Meyer called the compatible left, which in America translates into liberals and pseudo-intellectual status seekers who are easily influenced. All of that is ongoing, despite being exposed in the late 1960s. Various technological advances, including the Internet, have spread the network around the world, and many people don't even realize they are part of it, that they are promoting the CIA line. Assad's a butcher, they say, or Putin kills journalists, or China is repressive. They have no idea what they're talking about, but they spout all this propaganda. Nowadays, it goes way beyond the CIA. Several government agencies are propagandizing not only the American people, but the world. This includes the State Department and the military. The military is the nation's biggest advertiser, I believe, and the media depends on its revenue. Television especially isn't dependent on viewers, but on advertisers. So the media is probably more financially dependent on the military and the State Department than it is on the CIA, but the CIA laid the groundwork. The question one has to ask, given all this propaganda, is what makes CIA propaganda different than State Department or military propaganda, or even the red, white, and blue advertisements being thrown at the American people every second of every day? Everywhere you look, there are signs wrapped in American flags selling things, and that's propaganda too. It's just emanating from the business party. What makes CIA propaganda different? Rockwell, you make an interesting point about advertising. Doesn't the DEA do a huge amount of advertising too? Valentine, well, sure. The DEA is selling the notion that America is the victim in the war on drugs. It spouts this kind of nonsense at congressional hearings and through taxpayer-funded propaganda campaigns like DARE and Nancy Reagan's Just Say No idiocy. They coordinate their message with state and local law enforcement agencies and their civil offshoots. The DEA claims foreign countries like Mexico are pushing drugs on us, and therefore the DEA needs $50 billion a year to police the world and stop these horrible people, most of whom don't look like us. Meanwhile, the American demand for drugs persists, and the war goes on and on. But the propaganda is convincing, and Americans feel good that it's not their demand that's fueling the problem. It's the fault of a couple of cartels in Mexico. The FBI has a huge propaganda machine, too. Gangbuster J. Edgar Hoover understood how to promote FBI agents as heroic crime stoppers, as the good guys who got John Dillinger. Like the DEA, Hoover knew how to manipulate statistics and how to go after the proper criminals to promote the interests of his fiefdom. The government is composed of huge bureaucracies like the FBI and DEA, all competing for federal taxpayer dollars. They each have their own propaganda machine, which exists primarily for bureaucratic reasons, so that they can get a bigger piece of the federal budget. There are all sorts of reasons for propaganda, and many types of propaganda, and the CIA is one of the agencies engaged in self-promotion to get more of your money. But the CIA also has operational reasons for using propaganda to target particular people or nations. Rockwell, what is it that differentiates CIA propaganda from all the rest of these agencies? Valentine, the CIA advances the unstated goals and policies of the United States government, as opposed to the State Department, whose propaganda is promoting its stated objectives, which of course are wrapped in the same kinds of circumlocutions and euphemisms the CIA and military use. The language is pretty much the same for whichever agency is propagandizing, which adds to the confusion about where it's coming from. The purpose of CIA propaganda is to create plausible deniability, to hide or disguise the fact that it is the source of a particular piece of misinformation designed to mislead the American public. It has briefing officers who tell PR people in other government agencies what to say to hide the fact that it is engaged in a particular covert action that is designed to start a war or that supports a terrorist group or subverts a friendly government or promotes a fascist political party in Ukraine or a military dictatorship in South America. The sorts of things that, if the public was to find out that the U.S. government is doing them, would cause the president and the government embarrassment, like the attempted Gulen coup in Turkey. Journalists, of course, report all these carefully scripted communiques as fact. The CIA is in charge of doing the things that are illegal and anti-democratic. Its propaganda is generally referred to as gray or black propaganda. Black propaganda is used to completely disguise CIA operations and blame them on someone else, be they friends or enemies. Gray propaganda uses questionable sources. The sort of anonymous sources Seymour Hersh is famous for using. I'll give some examples. The CIA introduced New York Times reporter Chris Hedges to two Iraqi defectors who claimed in November 2001 that Saddam Hussein was training terrorists to attack America. That's black propaganda. It was completely untrue, but the lies could be blamed on the Iraqi defectors. The Ben Affleck film Argo, winner of multiple awards, told a fictionalized story of the CIA's successful rescue of several embassy employees held hostage in Tehran in 1979 and 1980. It was based on a book written by a CIA officer, and the CIA helped produce the film through its Old Boy Network and its entertainment industry liaison office. The CIA has an office that works with Hollywood. If a film is pro-CIA, it provides advisors. That's propaganda designed to rewrite history. In this case, the Canadians had more to do with the rescue than the CIA, and to give the CIA a good name and portray its officers as happy-go-lucky heroes. Journalists writing articles and authors of political books on current affairs tend to deliver CIA propaganda, some wittingly, others because they're stupid. There is an obscure discipline known as the interpretation of intelligence literature that involves studying these texts, like rabbis studying the Talmud for eschatological meaning, or English lit majors wondering why Eliot said, "Madame Blavatsky will instruct me in the seven sacred trances." There's an esoteric quality to propaganda that can drive some people crazy trying to figure it out. Some CIA officers spend their careers trying to unravel Russian propaganda. Some end up paranoid, seeing enemy agents everywhere. That's why Colby fired James Angleton. Angleton thought Colby was a Russian agent. Sometimes, however, it is easy to identify and discern the meaning behind CIA propaganda. Back in 2011, reporter Jeff Stein wrote an article about Fethullah Gulen, the American-based Turkish exile I referenced above. Gulen was accused of trying to overthrow Prime Minister Erdogan in July 2016. In his article, Stein referred to a memoir written by Osman Nuri Gündes, a top former Turkish intelligence official who alleged that the Gulen movement has been providing cover for the CIA since the mid-1990s. Citing the Paris-based Intelligence Online newsletter, Stein reported that the movement sheltered 130 CIA agents at its schools in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan alone. Having CIA agents operating out of schools in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan sounds like something the CIA would do. It's a great way of manipulating a social and political movement. Case officers could easily place principal agents, PAs, in the schools. The PAs could run agent nets or even assassins into Russia as legal travelers. Maybe the schools are spreading CIA propaganda. It was certainly influencing political and social movements. It may even front for a drug smuggling apparatus here and in Central Asia. Journalists like Stein know they have to look to foreign magazines and sources to get the true story about what the CIA is doing. At the same time, they have to maintain their credibility here in the States, which means they have to report the CIA line. Being a responsible journalist, Stein contacted two former CIA officers who both said the allegations were untrue, that the CIA would never do anything like that. So whom do you believe? The CIA or your own lying eyes? Stein's is not an article one needs to pick apart for hours, trying to figure out if it's gray or black propaganda or Russian disinformation. The New York Times, however, functions as the CIA's protector and thus dutifully published a series of stories that did their best to bury under a mound of disinformation and overtly biased reporting any hint that Gulen is a CIA agent. One article, steeped in schmaltz, described Gulen as a moderate who promotes interfaith dialogue, leads a worldwide network of charities and secular schools, favors good relations with Israel, and opposes harder-line Islamic movements like the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas. According to the New York Times, and as universally adopted as truth by its readers, someone who favors Israel and opposes Hamas is all right, even if, as it acknowledged, a former CIA official helped Gulen get a green card. The Times reporters did not explain that the CIA routinely creates and manipulates social and political movements like Gulen's and keeps them in place for decades until the time is right to launch a coup. They didn't explain that the Gulen movement ran one of Turkey's largest, most anti-Erdogan newspapers, or that the CIA uses such newspapers to spread propaganda before a coup. Instead, they cited Gulen's denials and his defenders at length. One expert said the Gulen movement was a golden generation of young people who are educated in science but have Muslim ethics. No one in the media will examine the network of schools the Gulen movement has planted in the U.S. to see if they are part of an elaborate CIA counter-espionage operation, like Operation Twofold, see Chapter 12, through which the CIA is hiding an operational unit that bumps off Gulen's political opponents. The fact that the mainstream media never looked too deeply into it proves it is a CIA operation. Indeed, the media does exactly the opposite. Within days of the coup, the writers' group PEN, which functions as a propaganda arm of the Israeli government and the CIA, sent all its members an urgent request to sign a petition to the Turkish government protesting the arrest of journalists involved in the coup. PEN never mentioned that many of the arrested journalists were, by virtue of their anti-Erdogan work on behalf of Gulen, tacitly working for the CIA. The purpose of signing such a meaningless petition is not to put pressure on Turkey, but to shape the assumptions of PEN's deluded members, to make them hate Turkey, which is not Israel's best friend. Rockwell, the CIA has always specialized in assassinations, the military too, but now we have the president openly assassinating people and claiming he has the right to. In the earliest days, the CIA was allegedly prevented from operating within the U.S. I think that was always a myth. Now the CIA is just openly and massively involved here. Do you think it is committing assassinations here as well? Valentine, it's impossible to prove. You'll never find a document that says the president ordered the CIA to kill some critic like Senator Paul Wellstone when Wellstone died in a suspicious plane crash. You're never going to find any proof that can be used in a court of law that would show the CIA conducted that kind of a political assassination within the United States. The CIA doesn't conduct that kind of an operation unless it's deniable. My inclination, based on everything I know about the CIA, is that, yes, they do. But I can't prove it because of the reasons I've just stated. They get the mafia to pay some petty crook to kill Martin Luther King Jr., and then work with what Fletcher Prouty called the secret team to cover it up. Rockwell, what's your opinion of Philip Agee's book, Inside the Company, CIA Diary? He was, of course, a former CIA agent who wrote about just how many people were on the payroll and how many people were controlled by the agency. Is that a persuasive book? Valentine, absolutely it is. Modern history of the CIA begins with Agee and his revelations. Nothing Agee said has been disproved. His fatal mistake was telling the truth, naming over 100 CIA officers and linking some of them to specific crimes. He was easily discredited on that basis alone, and anyone who reads Agee and responds rationally to his revelations is also by association a traitor. His revelations were akin to the collateral murder video Chelsea Manning gave to WikiLeaks. Manning was tormented and imprisoned for revealing the truth about what the CIA and military really do, which is the equivalent of treason in America. Agee was never imprisoned, but he was threatened and forced to settle in Cuba. Agee and his publishers revealed the inner workings of the CIA. It's not a coincidence that the church hearings followed pretty much on the heels of his revelations. A lot of things were coming out in the late 1960s and early 1970s, but Agee and later John Stockwell were the only CIA officers ever to reveal the CIA's criminal deeds, and more importantly, criminal intentions in operational detail. That will never happen again. After Agee and Stockwell, the CIA placed one of its officers, Rob Simmons, see Chapter 15, in the Senate Intelligence Committee, where Simmons shepherded the Agent Identities Act into law. It's now illegal to name CIA officers, and if you do, you go to prison like John Kiriakou, who exposed the CIA's use of waterboarding. That repressive measure was the legal outcome of Agee's revelations. Rockwell, we're finding out just now a lot more information about the Paris Review, a very influential literary publication, being in effect a CIA front. I've always been interested in National Review, one of my least favorite publications, which was founded by Bill Buckley, a former CIA agent. Maybe I should put former in quotes. A number of other former CIA people were also involved. This is a magazine that set out as its goal to destroy any anti-war feelings on the so-called right. Do you think that the National Review was a CIA operation too, like the Paris Review? Valentine. I'm glad you asked that question, because there are CIA agents who work for a CIA case officer and are on the payroll, and then there are people, in this case media propagandists, who do it for love. They inform on colleagues or otherwise help a spy agency for ideological reasons. Buckley is a perfect example of this. There are people who, by predilection, appear to be CIA officers, but are simply ideologically in sync with it and would do these things anyway. In Buckley's case, it isn't necessary to try to distinguish whether he was an agent of the CIA or just somebody doing it out of, like I say, love. Where you need to focus is not on people whose ideology is the same as the CIA's, but on the left, which in my usage of the term includes liberals. The Nation, for example, is a popular leftist liberal magazine. Would The Nation promote the CIA line in a particular instance? Could it be infiltrated? Could the CIA be directing some of its efforts in critical situations? The CIA doesn't have to infiltrate and direct the ultras. It directs its efforts at what Kordmeier called the compatible left. Kordmeier was associated with Operation Mockingbird, which was a way of courting the compatible left. This is what the CIA does. It's not courting Bill Buckley or the National Review, because the ultras already love the CIA and know exactly what to say about it. They say the same things as the CIA anyway. The CIA penetrates the media that pretend to be nonpartisan or leftist. The further to the left a magazine or a media outlet is, that's where the CIA would be found. Rockwell. For example, the Congress for Cultural Freedom in the early years, too. Valentine. Yes, the CIA doesn't have to tell the New York Times what to say. Arthur Oakes Sulzberger, Jr. and his staff know what to say. They're on the CIA's wavelength. They have the same interests and exist within the same stratospheric economic and political class. The CIA wants to know what everyone is thinking and planning, from Marine Le Pen to Benjamin Netanyahu to Bashar al-Assad. It is trying to influence everyone to as great an extent as possible. It's infiltrating socialist parties and trying to bring them over to the freewheeling capitalist model. They're going to concentrate in areas that are thought to harbor enemies of the United States, like the Chinese and Russians. They're going to infiltrate troublesome domestic groups as well. They're going to try to move the Black Lives Matter people to moderate their positions on equality. They're commandeering emigre groups like Gulens and redirecting them against foreign opponents within the United States. But mostly, they are trying to adjust American public opinion to support intervention abroad, arming Israel and Saudi Arabia and Egypt to keep the oil flowing. Rockwell. You know, Doug, if somebody wanted to learn about the CIA, what would be the books that you would tell them to read? Valentine. Regarding propaganda, people should read Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of the Mass Media, and Counter-Revolutionary Violence, Bloodbaths in Fact and Propaganda, both by Noam Chomsky and Edward S. Herman. For books about the CIA, I'd recommend A.G.'s and Stockwell's books, as well as Victor Marchetti's The CIA and the Cult of Intelligence. Another book from days gone by is Fletcher Prouty's The Secret Team, which does the best job explaining how the CIA hides itself in other agencies and how its briefing officers write the script for the rest of the government. I'd stay away from books written by anyone working for the New York Times. If you read books about the CIA by Evan Thomas or Tim Weiner, do so with a block of salt. They're basically advocating hero worship. I'd also stay away from academic books that rely on official documents, all of which, including the Pentagon Papers, as Prouty explains, have all the credibility of Bob Kerry's after-action report, the one that said his SEAL team killed 21 VC instead of 21 women and children. Those early books are important, but the CIA has undergone significant organizational changes in the last 15 years. The clandestine services have been reorganized and are under new names. It's a shell game. So these older books refer to the CIA organizationally in ways that are outdated, although the policies and practices haven't changed. It's important to read whatever information the CIA publishes about its organizational structure. It has a website that sketches its organizational structure, its different branches and divisions and what they do in a straightforward way. Looking at its organizational chart is the first step, while keeping in mind that, as with any organization, channels of power flow off the organizational chart. An organization, like the CIA, has back channels and ways of doing things that defy any kind of structural analysis. It's difficult to understand, like higher mathematics or the petrochemical industry. It takes serious study and a lot of effort. You have to read a lot of books, and you have to stay up to date. A serious student has to read a lot of translated foreign publications on the subject as well. You have to get into the details. For example, in 1989, there was an article in Marine Corps Gazette talking about modern warfare. That was 27 years ago. The authors of this article said, "The new type of warfare will be widely dispersed and largely undefined. The distinction between war and peace will be blurred to the vanishing point. There will be no definable battlefields or fronts. The distinction between civilian and military will disappear. Success will depend heavily on effectiveness and joint operations, as the lines between responsibility and mission become blurred." The kicker in the article was when they said that this new type of warfare will depend on psychological operations manifested in the form of media information intervention. All of this became standard operating procedure, at home and abroad, in terms of the military and CIA intervening in media information. The article said one must be adept at manipulating the media to alter domestic and world opinion. On this new psychological battlefield, television news may become a more powerful operational weapon than armored divisions. 27 years ago, before the internet, the military was talking about how, in the global village, national boundary lines would vanish and the U.S. would become the dominant power and influence events everywhere through the control of information. The article predicted that propaganda and psychological operations would become the defining factor in shaping political and social affairs. This was before Facebook allowed people to talk to people in Brazil or the Philippines or enemy nations like Russia or China. This was before we could read Russia Today and get information from sources that contradict the official U.S. line. The military and State Department and CIA understood that this was evolving and were making plans to control it. To become an individual who can look at all this information and understand that the CIA is covertly trying to manipulate it, to make you think, feel, and behave a certain way, well, that is a breathtakingly complex thing to do. It's almost impossible to try to figure out where a particular piece of information is coming from. Is it from the State Department, or the military, or the CIA? As the Marine Corps Gazette said, the boundaries have vanished. The information is so rapid and overwhelming, and mixed in with corporate messages, other kinds of messages that are coming at us. It's just like the person who wrote that article said, it's a blur. Guy Debord talks about it in The Society of the Spectacle. How can people adapt themselves and adjust their assumptions about reality in order to be able to discern within a media spectacle that produced Donald Trump as a viable presidential candidate what is really happening and where messages are coming from? It's an incredible challenge. People are so overwhelmed and alienated, they tend to withdraw, which is how Trump could create and control a social and political movement through tweets and symbolic messages. How can anyone begin to sort this out by reading a few books, if you see what I'm trying to say? Rockwell, but it still is possible, isn't it? It's just a matter of a lot of work. Valentine, oh, it's possible, because all the information is there. Rockwell, one last question. This is a huge question, so you may just want to sort of skip over it lightly. But since you're an expert on the DEA as well as the CIA, what about the story of CIA drug running? Is it true that in the late 1940s it began to get involved in the Golden Triangle and so forth, and maybe until recently used drugs for political and maybe financial purposes? Valentine, it's true. As I've explained elsewhere, the CIA made a point of infiltrating the DEA under the Nixon administration as a result of rising addiction in the U.S. being tied to the CIA's drug networks in the Far East. All that was being exposed. But prior to that, the CIA didn't have to tell the people who ran the DEA or its predecessor organizations that the drug wars were essentially political and dependent on psychological warfare. Starting in 1949, it was official U.S. policy to blame Communist China for America's drug problem. It was not true, but the CIA didn't need to tell the old Bureau of Narcotics to do that. The commissioner of the Bureau of Narcotics, Harry Anslinger, was one of the great propagandists of all time. He associated pot smoking with Mexicans trying to seduce white women. He associated heroin addictions with black musicians. He manipulated statistics in order to aim his agents at a rogues gallery of despised minorities and leftist organizations. Anslinger taught the CIA how to propagandize. He helped form the OSS. One of his senior agents, Garland Williams, went to England in 1942 with a man named Millard Preston Goodfellow, who was a Hearst executive and owned the Brooklyn Eagle. Williams and newspaper magnate Goodfellow were members of the Office of the Coordinator of Information. They went to England and met with John Keswick, who ran England's Special Operations Executive. Keswick had been involved in the opium trade in China, and based on that knowledge and experience, was put in charge of England's Special Operations Executive, which conducted dirty tricks in World War II. Williams and Goodfellow returned to Washington with the SOE's training manuals and set up the OSS. In other words, the guys who created the CIA included a narcotics agent who taught OSS officers how to avoid the security forces of foreign nations, which is what the narcotics people had been doing for decades. Not surprisingly, it was a newspaper man who taught the OSS how to control the message. This stuff is standard operating procedure. It doesn't matter whether it's the DEA, CIA, FBI, or the military. These people all know what to do. They mostly do it for their own different bureaucratic reasons, but the CIA ultimately controls the final product. Rockwell. Well, Doug Valentine, thank you for what you do. This is not the sort of career that leads to power and wealth. You've chosen the path of truth and of teaching truth, and we're all very much in your debt. Please come back on the show again. This has been terrific. Valentine, you're very welcome. I would love to. Chapter 21. Disguising Obama's Dirty Wars. In a speech to West Point cadets delivered in early December 2009, President Barack Obama declared, "We're in Afghanistan to prevent a cancer from once again spreading throughout that country. But this same cancer has also taken root in the border region of Pakistan. That's why we need a strategy that works on both sides of the border." The hackneyed phrasing and use of the buzzword cancer signaled that Obama's troop surge in Afghanistan, announced a week earlier in direct opposition to his campaign promises to reduce U.S. military presence in Muslim nations, would adhere to the dictates of what the CIA calls political and psychological warfare, the cornerstones of any counterinsurgency. As I've stressed throughout this text, political and psychological warfare depends on information management. In this case, the careful revising of history and official government communiques to conceal the fact that American covert actions and unstated policies, including its reliance on drug trafficking warlords, were responsible for the so-called cancer in the first place. Indeed, at a meeting a month before Obama announced the surge, the U.S. ambassador in Kabul advised against a large buildup of forces, according to one report, as long as the Karzai government remained unreformed. Regional Commander General David Petraeus told Mr. Obama to think of elements of the Karzai government like a crime syndicate. Ambassador Eikenberry was suggesting, in effect, that America could not get in bed with the mob. All of this rhetoric was completely disingenuous, given that America had installed the Karzai crime syndicate in the first place. Let's review the actual history. America's ignoble defeat in Vietnam in 1975 did not end its militant anti-communist jihad, which President Carter simply repackaged and sold as a policy of promoting human rights. While Carter was preaching human rights, his national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, was secretly subverting the pro-Soviet regime that had ascended in Afghanistan in 1978. The covert actions began immediately and consisted of CIA case officers recruiting, funding, arming, and forming warlords from Afghanistan's non-Pashtun ethnic groups into the infamous Northern Alliance. Through allied Islamic nations like Saudi Arabia, the CIA also recruited mercenaries like Osama bin Laden and aimed them against the secular communists. Brzezinski's big idea was to provoke Soviet military intervention and drag the Russians into a debilitating Vietnam-style war through a carefully sustained insurgency. The cancer America was eradicating at the time was communism, along with its goals of income equality and liberation of the Afghan women, who were encouraged to attend universities and get jobs. Like Monsanto, selling dioxin-laced herbicides to happy American suburbanites as the solution to their lawn problems, the CIA launched an information campaign to convince Muslims that communism was antithetical to Islam's basic tenets, such as the belief in God. To wipe out the commie weeds, the CIA created the Mujahideen, paving the way for Al-Qaeda. It created the civil war that destroyed Afghanistan's emerging modern society. Just as mighty U.S. corporations in search of profits produce the toxins that create actual cancer, the CIA created the conditions that prompted the traumatized Taliban to arise from the ashes of the CIA-provoked civil war in an attempt to restore law and some semblance of order to their nation. If Obama really wanted to rid the world of cancer, maybe he should have bombed Monsanto or sicked his death squads on the tobacco companies. While we're on the subject of carcinogens, Obama borrowed a page from Carter, and while visiting Vietnam in the spring of 2016, chided the Hanoi government for human rights violations. He did so without acknowledging the horrific plague of cancers the U.S. visited on Vietnam through the systematic spraying of some 20 million gallons of Agent Orange over 12% of Vietnam, adversely affecting over 3 million innocent people. And don't think this is Vietnam War history. It's a huge problem today. As Marjorie Cohn noted in December 2015, those exposed to Agent Orange during the war often have children and grandchildren with serious illnesses and disabilities. The international scientific community has identified an association between exposure to Agent Orange and some forms of cancer, reproductive abnormalities, immune and endocrine deficiencies, and nervous system damage. Second and third generation victims continue to be born in Vietnam, as well as to U.S. veterans and Vietnamese Americans in this country. Individual CIA officers made liberal use of poisons in Vietnam as early as 1961, when, according to Tom Ahern in his book Vietnam Declassified, CIA officer Ralph Johnson's Vietnamese counterpart proposed deploying special teams to poison VC rice depots, booby-trap VC munitions depots, kill or capture VC cadre in ambushes or in raids on communist-controlled villages, and gather intelligence. Johnson endorsed this program, saying he expected it to tie down Viet Cong military forces and reduce communist pressure on Montagnard villages. While stationed in Kien Ho province in 1964, Ahern proposed the use of sophisticated booby traps, incendiaries, and materials toxic to livestock in areas considered to be under uncontested communist control. Ahern encouraged this despite the possibility of civilian casualties and suggested using leaflet drops to warn that persons using particular routes now incurred mortal danger. CIA officers like Ahern were well aware of the cancer they were spreading. The U.S. government, along with its British allies, developed dioxin in the 1940s as a weapon of war ostensibly to destroy Nazi and Japanese crops. They had known since the 1950s that it, along with nuclear fallout, was a lethal cancer-causing agent. The U.S. also knew what would happen to its own expendable soldiers as well as the Vietnamese people by saturating Vietnam with dioxin, just as it knew what would happen when it planted the Mujahideen cancer in Afghanistan. When asked if he regretted creating terrorists, Brzezinski replied, What is most important to the history of the world, the Taliban or the collapse of the Soviet Empire? Some stirred up Muslims or the liberation of Central Europe and the end of the Cold War? When asked by Leslie Stahl if she regretted that U.S. sanctions on Iraq had led to the death of 500,000 children, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright said, "We think the price is worth it." Albright's comment was made on 60 Minutes in 1996, but as reported by Rahul Mahajan, a Dow Jones search of mainstream news sources since September 11 turns up only one reference to the quote in an op-ed in the Orange County Register, 9/16/01. This omission is striking, given the major role that Iraq's sanctions play in the ideology of archenemy Osama bin Laden. His recruitment video features pictures of Iraqi babies wasting away from malnutrition and lack of medicine, New York Daily News, 9/28/01. The inference that Albright and the terrorists may have shared a common rationale, a belief that the deaths of thousands of innocents are a price worth paying to achieve one's political ends, does not seem to be one that can be made in U.S. mass media. Commenting in October 2011 about her needless destruction of Libya and the ramming of a knife up Muammar Gaddafi's rectum, Hillary Clinton chortled majestically, "We came, we saw, he died." Being an exceptional American means never having to say you're sorry. If you're a top American leader, it also means never going to prison. Left as right. Delivered a week after he addressed cadets at West Point, Obama's Nobel Prize acceptance speech, in which he boasted about ordering the Guantanamo Torture Center closed, marked an important juncture for him as he took on the job of selling more war in Afghanistan. It didn't matter that American hands had already been stained by the blood of thousands of innocents killed in bombing raids. Never mind all that innocent blood. Obama's double talk was hailed by neoconservatives who believed they had surprisingly found in the young biracial president a far more effective spokesman for their interventionist causes than the inarticulate, buffoonish George W. Bush. "The shift in rhetoric at Oslo was striking," observed neocon theorist Robert Kagan in a Washington Post op-ed. Gone was the vaguely left-revisionist language that flavored earlier speeches, highlighting the low points of American global leadership, the coups and ill-considered wars, and lowballing the highlights, such as the Cold War triumph. But then, those words were intended for the American public, with a view to winning an election. Indeed, in his Oslo speech, Obama shoved six decades of bloody low points behind one five-word clause: "Whatever mistakes we have made." Obama more than willingly shouldered the job of arms salesman for the war in Afghanistan. He reveled in his role as custodian of the kill list and boasted of his power to cross international borders to assassinate Taliban leaders in Pakistan and later an American citizen in Yemen. Under Obama's stewardship, the role of the president evolved from moral leader to predator drone orchestrator conducting surgical hits. Being a tough guy who enjoys murder is also a popular stance in America. Obama leaves office in the summer of 2016 with a 51% approval rating. But it was never necessary for Obama to win the support of the majority of the American public for the war on terror. Programmed Americans instinctively rally around the flag and support the troops. It is the knee-jerk reaction Obama and the national security establishment counted on when they sent 30,000 soldiers to Afghanistan. And even though the surge would eventually count among mistakes we made, decades of political and psychological warfare have successfully shifted the responsibility for those mistakes from leaders with good intentions onto the general public, which has as its only obligation the moral imperative to support the troops. The trick is to make the public feel, every day in every way, that there is an ongoing urgent need for wars they must support. So Obama packaged his surge as a cure for cancer. He made it an involuntary matter of personal survival, like the radiation and chemotherapy treatments that take a terrible toll on a patient's body, but are necessary if the patient wants to live. 15 years after Bush invaded Afghanistan and provoked its current civil war, The American public is still paying for some magical cure that will stop the fear and insecurity its leaders created, a condition of psychological dependence that makes the public incapable of shaking off its political oppressors here at home. Beyond relying on alternating doses of medicinal fear and patriotism, Obama's incestuous war council, symbolized by the marriage of neocon Robert Kagan and Obama's neoliberal Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, Victoria Nuland, knows that public confusion is helpful. Most Americans don't have the time to learn what really happened in Afghanistan, in this case, that there was never an insurgency to counter, but rather a resistance movement to American military occupation by Afghan nationalists. One could say that America's unstated policy of conquest through massive corruption was a mistake, or one could say that the national security establishment wanted to control the drug trade and use the profits to train a new generation of special operations forces, who since 9/11 primarily invade private homes at midnight on targeted snatch-and-snuff missions, and thus refer to themselves as door kickers, while colonizing Afghanistan and using it as a base to subvert Russia and China. Either way you say it, that's what intentionally happened and will continue to happen. What is counterinsurgency? In his speeches, President Obama defines America's objectives in Afghanistan as 1. Suppressing the Taliban resistance forces to American military occupation and the corrupt puppet regime the U.S. installed in 2001. 2. Eliminating several Arab terrorists. And 3. Creating a stable pro-American government and economic infrastructure. David Galula, author of Counterinsurgency Warfare, Theory and Practice, and a recognized authority on the matter, stressed that counterinsurgency includes building or rebuilding a political apparatus within the population. In this sense, any counterinsurgency is also an insurgency. It just depends on who is telling the story and when the story begins. In Afghanistan, the Taliban ruled for several years until the CIA's Northern Alliance drove them out. Since the Civil War, there have been two governments. Obama's successor will continue to define the Taliban as the insurgents, but the Taliban, who by 2005 once again controlled many parts of Afghanistan, view the Americans as invaders backing a corrupt insurgency that undermines traditional Muslim law. As every government propagandist knows, the essence of existence is no longer to be or not to be, but to define or be defined. Thus, military occupation is not a phrase one hears when Americans tell the story of Afghanistan. One only hears the word counterinsurgency. But the U.S. military's strategy for defeating the Taliban has always been to clear and hold territory the corrupt warlords on its payroll covet for economic purposes. To clear and hold means to drive the resistance out of their secure areas in the countryside through Phoenix-style operations perfected in Vietnam. Such operations range from small-unit death squads like Bob Kerry's, when his SEAL team slaughtered the women and children of Tan Phong, just like the U.S. commandos did in Ghazi Khan 40 years later. The idea in either case is to terrorize the public into no longer supporting the resistance movement. This terror strategy worked in Iraq. According to the story told by Washington's ruling national security establishment, President George W. Bush's 2007 surge and the clear-and-hold strategy won the war in Iraq, although it merely gave rise to ISIS, yet another cancer. As in Afghanistan in 2002, the reality in Iraq is diametrically opposed to the story we have been told. More important than the surge and the temporary drop in violence were the massive bribes, billions of Pentagon dollars are still unaccounted for, used to pay off Sunni tribes in 2006, along with Bush's agreement in 2008 to reduce the U.S. military presence. But that is not what Bush and Obama wanted people to believe. For instance, establishment propagandists Evan Thomas and John Barry at Newsweek asserted that the clear and hold strategy worked because it protected the friendly civilians who provided the tips that enabled the CIA and its special forces sidekicks to find and kill people who were, as in Bob Carey's after-action report at Tan Phong, said to be terrorists or members of the resistance. By ratcheting back the heavy use and overuse of firepower, they claimed, U.S. military commander in Afghanistan General Stanley McChrystal has reduced civilian casualties, which alienate the locals and breed more jihadists. The reality, however, is far less humane and clinical. 1. It is false to assert that a counterinsurgency is gentler than the shock and awe of, say, the Iraq invasion. Such an assertion is propaganda intended to deceive its target population in the United States into thinking that innocents are not being intentionally killed and robbed of everything they own. 2. The assertion that only jihadists are targeted for assassination obscures the fact that thousands of people are fighting not for religious reasons, but for nationalist reasons. Afghans, or name your target population, are simply opposed to American invaders and their corrupt collaborators. 3. The notion that civilians provide information because they are friendly to the Americans is misleading, since most intelligence is coerced or bought. Only in the world of illusion created by Barry and Thomas can a warlord like Ghul Aga Sherzai, whose tips in 2001 led to the massacre of hundreds of his personal rivals and sparked the Civil War, be said to be a friend. As Anand Gopal revealed in No Good Men Among the Living, Sherzai supplied the CIA with a network of informants that targeted their business rivals, not the Taliban. In return, Sherzai received the contract to build the first U.S. military base in Afghanistan, along with a major drug franchise. In an effort to create an insurgency and a pretext for eternal military occupation, the CIA methodically began torturing and killing Afghanistan's most revered leaders in a series of Phoenix-style raids that radicalized the Afghan people. The Newsweek propagandists were correct only when they said that Obama's dirty war was modeled on the Phoenix program, whose goal was to target and assassinate Viet Cong leaders. As usual, they only told the part of the story they wanted people to hear. They didn't add that waging a successful dirty war depends on spreading disinformation as to who is the enemy and why they and everyone around them are being killed. Intelligence. Intelligence is gained primarily through informants, detainees, interrogations, defectors, electronic intercepts, and secret agents. 1. Voluntary informants like Sherzai typically work for money and vengeance. Ideology is a factor, but more often informants in a civil war are given no choice. Fracturing a society or culture into opposing factions, Sunni versus Shia, and then coercing rivals into becoming informants is the CIA's strong suit. 2. Detainees also provide coerced information in an effort to escape a jerry-rigged legal system in which due process is denied and spilling the beans is the only alternative to torture and death. Producing and coercing detainees is one of the CIA's major means of assuring that a society will remain divided and manageable. Sowing suspicion, fear, and confusion keeps a subject population suppressed. 3. In the Afghan conflict, interrogations are conducted by members of the Afghan National Army, ANA, the Afghan Secret Police, KHAD, or private militias operated by warlords like Sherzai. When not actually conducted under the supervision of CIA and military officers in jointly managed facilities, torture sessions are conducted unofficially by private militias acting as CIA mercenary forces. High-value targets captured in unilateral CIA operations are tortured in secure facilities off-limits to militiamen. Not publicized by Newsweek is the fact that the CIA and U.S. military purchased from members of the corrupt Afghan government the right to operate secret torture and detention centers, as well as the right to use unilateral paramilitary teams to target, capture, and kill Afghans who pose security risks to its profitable drug network. Based on administrative detention laws developed in Vietnam, the CIA's secret detention and torture centers were supposed to be handed over to the Afghan secret police. Suspects theoretically appear before review boards that afford them a fleeting chance to present evidence of their innocence. Reporters and international human rights officials are supposed to have access to the trials. The reality is far different. As reported in the 28 November 2009 Washington Post, two Afghan teenagers held in U.S. detention north of Kabul this year said they were beaten by American guards, photographed naked, deprived of sleep, and held in solitary confinement in concrete cells for at least 2 weeks while undergoing daily interrogation about their alleged links to the Taliban. 4. The CIA's defector programs for Muslims evolved from the CIA's Chu Hoi program for communists in Vietnam. Defector programs are the essence of political and psychological warfare and rely totally on the control of information. A typical defector program consists of dropping leaflets on a targeted village in a secure enemy area. The leaflets promise mutilation and slow death to those who resist, and riches beyond one's wildest dreams to those who defect. Immediately upon defecting, defectors are interrogated, often by former comrades who have defected and repented. Defectors are made to prove their loyalty by providing actionable intelligence so military operations can be mounted immediately. Having proven their worth, defectors are then taught the American line by other defectors. To further prove their sincerity, they are then conscripted into CIA-funded militias and sent back to contact other resistance members and recruit more defectors. Defectors are used as pseudo-insurgents in black propaganda operations and as translators and interrogators in torture centers. The CIA's espionage operations are populated by defectors. 5. American electronic intercepts are entirely unilateral and directed mostly against the various agencies of the puppet Afghan government, as a way of detecting double agents and discovering information that can be used to bribe and coerce officials in the puppet regime. 6. The CIA and U.S. military run agents in liaison with militia leaders like Sherzai, as well as with subservient police and military officials in the Afghan government. Often, however, the militias target police and military officials belonging to rival tribes. Thus, the CIA values most highly its unilateral agents within the various militias and government agencies in order to keep in touch with real events as opposed to the stories it tells to the press. It is difficult recruiting agents within the Taliban leadership, which is composed of religious clerics who dispense justice, not social services per se. Taliban leaders have not succumbed to the cash nexus and are not easily bribed. They do not have bookkeepers, nor do they organize in Western-style corporate hierarchies. They do not issue press releases, broadcast their plans and strategies, or allow photography, which can confound CIA assassins. These ideological precepts make them nearly impervious to blackmail, extortion, and corruption, the CIA's standard means of penetrating the enemy infrastructure, and the means by which it controls top-ranking officials in the Afghani government. The Taliban leadership does meet with foreigners to negotiate land and mineral rights, as well as to form alliances. But after being preemptively manhunted for 15 years, they are loath to deal with Americans, which further hampers the CIA's ability to penetrate their ranks. The Taliban's cultural practices make it hard to know if any intelligence gathered is reliable, but that does not much matter. The Taliban, according to Hillary Clinton, treat their women like animals, and that is reason enough to wipe them off the planet and steal everything they own. The main function of intelligence in the Afghan dirty war is to create public support for U.S. government policies. Intelligence managers skew intelligence to this political purpose, as happened with the bogus reports of WMD in Iraq. Any policy can find supporting intelligence, especially when the meaning of words is garbled by Afghan or Iraqi or Syrian collaborators and U.S. officials who are required to report what the CIA wants to hear, and which they disseminate respectively for their own survival and or career advancement. As Phoenix Program veteran Stan Fulcher explained to me, the Vietnamese lied to us. We lied to the Phoenix Directorate, and the Directorate made it into documented fact. It was a war that became distorted through our ability to create fiction. Intelligence programs have two other functions in a dirty war. One is to map out the clandestine organizations that drive the resistance so they can be destroyed. At the secret detention and torture centers it operates in Afghanistan, the CIA draws up blacklists of actual and fabricated Taliban cadres based on their social and family ties, position within the infrastructure, age, sex, and profession, etc. The idea is to send paramilitary teams out to capture them, make them inform on their comrades, turn them into double agents, or kill them and their families and friends. None have the right to due process. Some of these death squad operations have surfaced during U.S. military disciplinary proceedings. In one case, an Afghani identified as suspected insurgent leader Nawab Buntangyar was encountered on 13 October 2006 by an Afghan army patrol led by U.S. Special Forces Captain Dave Staffel. Afraid that the suspected terrorist might be wearing a suicide vest, the Americans kept their distance while checking his description against the CIA's kill or capture list. Concluding that the man was indeed Buntangyar, Staffel ordered American sniper Troy Anderson to fire from a distance of about 100 yards away, putting a bullet through the man's head and killing him instantly. The soldiers viewed the killing as a textbook example of a classified mission completed in accordance with the American rules of engagement, the International New York Times reported. The men said such rules allowed them to kill Buntangyar, whom the American military had designated a terrorist cell leader once they positively identified him. When Staffel's civilian lawyer said the Army's Criminal Investigation Command concluded that the shooting was justifiable homicide, a two-star general in Afghanistan then initiated a murder charge against Staffel and Anderson. Both were released on technicalities. An even more telling tale involved Sergeant Major Anthony Pryor, who in 2007 was awarded the Silver Star for gallantry in action. As Pryor said modestly at the award ceremony, "I just did what I had to do." Anand Gopal chronicled the actual event in No Good Men Among the Living. In his book, Gopal told how Pryor's Special Forces A-Team attacked a schoolhouse where Al-Qaeda terrorists were said to be hiding. It was January 2002, only 3 months after the U.S. launched its invasion of revenge for 9/11. The men in the schoolhouse were said to have defended themselves, but were overwhelmed. As Pryor soon discovered, the men he attacked were part of a pro-American local government. Like Bob Kerry after Tan Phong, Pryor claims he acted in self-defense, Gopal wrote. But Khas Uruzgan residents point out that the bodies were found in their beds, handcuffed, and there were no signs of struggle. Either way, every official was killed. As Gopal noted, the massacre would have been controversial anyway, but the schoolhouse was within the governor's compound. The anti-Taliban police chief lived in the compound, but he too was beaten and kidnapped. The governor, Tawildar Yunis, heard the commotion and escaped, but others were summarily shot in the head. The survivors were put in an AC-130 gun.